Hello and welcome to the Psych Files, what psychology is really all about. Michael Britt here, host of the Psych Files, and in this episode we're going to talk about flashbulb memories. Flashbulb memories refer to the memories you have regarding particularly powerful events in your past. Right now, most people refer to the September 11 attacks as an event that around which you probably have a particularly strong memory. So take a moment to think about that. Where were you when you heard about it? And who were you with? And any other details around it? What is the memory that comes to mind when you first heard about those attacks? And how did you feel at the time? As you think about that memory, how confident are you in what you're remembering? Because most people are pretty confident. They say, "Well, I know I was here, and I was at work at the time, or I was having breakfast, and I was sitting there, and it came on the television, or you know, somebody came into the room and said, 'Did you hear about it? My wife, my roommate, my friend, whatever.'" So think about that. There's lots of different kinds of events that you could have flashbulb memories about. Other ones would be, for example, let's see, I got a list of them here. We used to refer to the Challenger explosion, the explosion of the Challenger shuttle back in 86, I think that was. Most people who, you know, were around then and remember that event and can tell you where they were. Other kinds of events around which a lot of people have flashbulb memories would be the death of Princess Diana, the Columbine massacre. Much further back, we would go to the assassination of John Kennedy, maybe Martin Luther King, other ones, maybe the Virginia Tech killings, and possibly even the O.J. Simpson trial. All right, so these are events that most people know about, and lots of people were tuned into. Okay, so the question is, if you've given that a moment to think about where you were and what you were doing, is it accurate? Because we think that those memories are accurate. We may not remember what we were doing on, July 3rd of 2003, you know, those sorts of everyday events, but most of us feel confident we know what we were doing when the attacks occurred. And what's surprising, surprised me actually, because I used to think, oh yeah, I know exactly where I was, is there, it probably is. I'm not going to say, oh, you know, you're totally wrong. No, not the case. You probably is a piece of that memory which is accurate, but I think you'd be surprised at how small that piece is. Flashbulb memories are characterized by people being just certain about what they were doing and who they were with and how it happened and how they heard about it. But when we look at it really carefully and do some studies around it, we find that actually, no, there's a lot of inconsistency. You might be surprised. Of course, there's really maybe no way to figure this out exactly. You might, unless you talked with someone and say, "Let me just make sure I'm right. Wasn't it you who told me about it?" And corroborate this with other people. It might be interesting for you to learn what that other person says. So what I wanted to do in this episode is just talk about a couple of studies that have been done very systematically to look at this issue. And just to tie it into a recent current event here, I'm a big fan of science fiction. And right now, one of the better shows on the air is called Fringe. Maybe you're a fan. And Fringe likes to use this idea that our memories record everything that happens to us in exact detail. It's just not always available to us. Right? A very interesting idea. And the way you'll see lots of different ways that, if you watch the show, that they try to access these buried memories. A lot of times through medication, sometimes through one of those tanks. I forget the name of those tanks that you lie in. I think there's salt water in there. Right? It removes all of all the possible sensations so you can't hear anything. Gosh, I have to get the name of that tank. So you're in this very restricted environment. So if we remove all of the ideas, sensations, then you would be able to travel back into your mind and get to these memories. So really interesting idea. It makes for some great plot lines. If only it were true. We just do not find that there's anything to that idea. So it's fun to think about, but we find that our memories, and I wanted to go into this in a future episode as well, to talk more about false memories, but we find that our memories are really just a patchwork, really more reconstructive, because we add all kinds of things in order to make it feel like we have a full memory. But actually, it's been influenced by a number of things. Okay, so we'll go into that later. So how do you do this? Okay, how do you study this idea of flashbulb memory and whether or not it's accurate? Suppose you're really interested in this. You're a psychologist, maybe cognitive psychologist. You want to study memory for flashbulb-type events. Well, what do? Do you sit around and wait for some major event that will probably affect lots and lots of people? Because, I mean, flashbulb memories could also be the day you were married, your first date, your first kiss. I mean, those could be flashbulb memories for you. The day you broke your arm, I'll never forget. But those, those are individual. How do we study events across a lot of people? Well, believe it or not, and I was surprised at this, researchers were ready for the September 11 attacks. Because we have a flashbulb memory questionnaire all set and ready to go. Here's an interesting article. It's called Delay-Related Changes in Personal Memories for September 11. Peter Lee, Norman Brown, is published in 2003. And they're from the University of Alberta, Canada. Now, that's important, actually, because there's a two-hour difference between New York City, where the attacks occurred, and Edmonton, Canada. Okay. Now, why is that important? Well, that means, quote, researchers could begin preparing materials before many of their students at the college even became aware of the event. So here's an interesting situation where they were aware of the attacks 2 hours before their students were. So that gave them 2 hours to prepare, and they knew this is going to become a flashbulb memory for many, many people because it was so unbelievable of an event. So they're ready with the flashbulb memory questionnaire, ready to go. So what did they do? Okay, so they were able to get a large number of students who were coming to class that day. Right? In fact, 1,481 undergraduates, University of Alberta. And so what they thought they would do is, all right, let's give them this flashbulb memory questionnaire immediately, what they call wave one, all right? Although, actually, it's between 4 hours and 24 hours, close after the attack, and then bring them back 10 days later, on the 21st of September, and give them the test again. The questions were things like, who were you with? Where were you? What were you doing at the time? Your emotional response at the time? And then usually they're asked, how confident are you about this information that you've just given? Okay. So there's the wave one, immediately after the event, wave two, 10 days later, and then finally wave three, and that would be held in April of 2002. All right, it's about 8 months later. So all they're going to do is compare the facts across those three times, immediately, 10 days, 8 months. Okay, and so what they looked at, what they measured precisely was things like the amount of information. So a simple word count is one thing you can do. How many words did you use to describe the event? Assuming that you would use less words as time went on, because you remember less of it. Oddly enough, though, participants wrote more words in wave two than they did in wave one. So interestingly, they seem to remember more things after some time had passed. But after the 8 months, they wrote less. They're not quite sure why that happened. They're thinking that immediately after the event, there's such a high level of emotional arousal that they weren't able to write very much. But 10 days later, the emotional arousal regarding the event passed a little bit and they were able to write more words. Okay, so how did they score these open-ended, these descriptions of what you were doing at the time? Well, they had people score them on a 3-point scale, which is, actually it's 2, 1, and 0. So if you were completely consistent from the first time to the second time to the third time, you got a 2. In other words, all of your facts are consistent, where you were, who you were with, what you were doing. If it's partially inconsistent, you got a 1. For example, here's a partially inconsistent one. Quote, I was in the shower when my mom called me. And then at the second time, quote, I was drying my hair when my mom called me. So you weren't in exactly the same place, but it's you know, general, right? That's a 1-point answer. And if you were completely inconsistent, as in this case, quote, I was driving to campus versus the second time I was in class. So there's obviously consistent inconsistency there. You got a 0. Okay, so how much consistency was there? They found that about 66% of their respondents were consistent across time. Now, that's not too bad, 66%, but it does leave about a third there who were either inconsistent, a little bit inconsistent to very inconsistent. In fact, I'll quote from them, considering the nature of the target event, the September 11th attack, and the short delay between the test and the retest, now here they're talking about wave 1 and wave 2, this figure is low. All right, so interesting. Not the only study. Let me give you one more. And then there's an interesting study here about President Bush's memory at the time. Okay, so here's another study. Jennifer Talarco and David Rubin, called Confidence, Not Consistency, Characterizes Flashbulb Memories. Okay, so they're from Duke. Okay, contacted students, Duke students, about their memory, about hearing about the terrorist attacks. And they did this the day after. Okay, so September 12th. And so they got a bunch of students and randomly assigned them to one of three conditions. 7 days after the event, 18 days after the event, and 42 days. And I'm sorry, finally, another group tested 224 days, or 32 weeks, after the event. They asked them some of the similar questions about September 11th, but they also asked them about some everyday event prior to September 11th, just to be able to compare their memory for the flashbulb event versus an everyday event. Now, they gave them a bunch of interesting questions, though, such as this. I feel as though I'm reliving the experience, from 1 to 7. While remembering the event now, I feel that I have traveled back in time to the time that it happened. Another one, quote, I believe the event in my memory really occurred the way I remember it. Participants were also asked how much they could see it in their mind, how much they could hear it in their mind, and how clearly did they feel they know the setting where they were at the time. Okay, so they call that they put all these together and called it a vividness measure. So what do they find? Well, interestingly, comparing flashbulb to everyday, memory decayed over time. Quote here, as shown by both decreasing number of consistent details and increasing number of inconsistent details. And this was true for both the flashbulb memories and memories of everyday events. Quote, flashbulb memories are not immune to forgetting, nor are they uncommonly consistent over time. This seems to be strong evidence for the absence of a special mechanism for the consistency of flashbulb memories. Instead, exaggerated belief in your memory's accuracy at long delays is what's more common. A belief that is unrelated to the true memory consistency. So you are not consistent in your memories, but you think you are. Now, what's interesting is this piece right here. that quote from them. Flashbulb memories came as more coherent stories than everyday memories. In other words, and this is the interesting part, if you were asked about an everyday memory, something that happened, say, a week ago, you would have some pieces, some little piece here, little piece there. Well, I was doing this. It would be disjointed. But if you're asked about a flashbulb memory, you would tell a narrative, they call it here, a story. It would be much more fleshed out. You would say, well, first I was here, and then this happened, and then that happened. It would be this kind of, as I say, story. And that characterizes this. And I'm going to do a follow-up episode on memories, but what we find, we know how much we love story. Stories are, they draw us in. In a previous episode, I talked about the motivation to learn. We are grabbed by stories. And it looks like what we tend to do is construct a story around this memory of ours. A story which may not have all the facts right, but we feel confident about it. Final piece to this is interesting, especially if you're an American. I know I have lots of international listeners to the Psych Files, which is fantastic, but hopefully you still found this episode interesting. At the time, of course, we had President Bush. Where was he when he heard about it? Now, oddly enough, you may remember, you may picture him being in a classroom, right, which has become part of our own memory. Oh, yeah, the president, he was in a classroom at the time, I think, right? Now, when he was asked, where were you when you heard about it? What's really interesting is that, not unlike us, he had a lot of inconsistencies in where he was. Let's see now. They of course, everything he says is public. So he was asked, where were you? Now, this is December 4th. So he's saying this about 2.5 months afterwards. Quote, I was in Florida, and my chief of staff, Andy Card. No, actually, I was in a classroom. I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower. The TV was obviously on. Now, this is interesting. Because, as we'll see in a follow-up episode, you can see that the reconstruction going on here. Well, if I saw it, then the TV must have been on. In other words, a lot of what we do is infer what must have happened from the facts that we give. I mean, obviously, the TV must have been on. What other pieces? You could just sense that he's pulling this together, as we do. Then, on December 20th, about 2 weeks later, he was asked about this event. Where was he? And here I don't have a quote, but the story he told, that it was actually Karl Rove who brought him the news. So it's a different person. And then on January 5th of 2002, he was asked again, and he says, well, I was sitting there, my chief of staff. Well, first of all, when we walked into the classroom, I had seen this plane fly into the first building. So now he says he was in the classroom, he was out of the classroom. So you can see the inconsistency here. Now, okay, so not unusual. What's interesting about this, and I didn't know this at the time, is that the inconsistencies, which we now know to be quite normal for all of us, those who like to believe in conspiracy believe that the inconsistencies in his stories must, of course, add up to some kind of conspiracy. He saw the video of the first plane crashing into the building. Quote from this article here, at that time, there was no footage of the first plane crashing into the building. So he couldn't have seen the first plane crashing into the building. So it couldn't be accurate. But I mean, how many times did you see the video footage of the planes crashing into the building? Obviously, many, many times. So do you remember which one was which? And do you know when the footage was obtained? I mean, these are obviously what happens to us is events after the flashbulb memory can influence us into thinking that what we saw on television is what we experienced. That's how mushed up our memory can get. This inaccuracy left room for many people to claim that, well, this is proof that, and here's a quote from a website at the time, which says that, quote, complicit factions of the U.S. federal government, including virtually all upper-level members of the Bush administration, actually filmed their own attack on the New York World Trade Center. So in other words, well, if he says he saw the first attack, then he must have filmed it. The alternative explanation, of course, is that he's inaccurate memory. And the other interpretation you could have is that he's not telling the truth about everything he knows, which, again, means there's a conspiracy. Now, we love conspiracies, and I love, conspiracies on television. I loved Lost and all that sort of thing. But you see how quickly we can jump to conspiracy, when really what we're talking about is inaccurate memories. As they say, authors say here, quote, we need only consider the frailty of human memory. All right, so in future episodes, I want to talk more about memory itself. Very interesting topic. And so I hope this has been interesting, and I'm sorry if it disappoints you a little bit that your memories of flashbulb events, which you felt so confident about, me too, I guess they're not as accurate as we had thought. All right, that's episode number 124. And if you have a chance, stop by in iTunes and check out. I've got an app there, the companion app, that will allow you to have all 124 episodes in your iPhone available at any time. So I appreciate if you had a chance to purchase that. It's only $2.99 and it helps to support the podcast. And I'm working on another app that will be coming out this summer for the iPhone and the iPad. So some interesting things happening later in the summer. Okay, well, thanks a lot for joining me in this little walk down memory lane. And hope to see you next time for episode 125 of the Psych Files. All right, thanks a lot and take care.